You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, we'll find out how psychologists in Madison are helping treat adolescents with a condition that was once seen as untreatable.
First, government investment in research carried out in colleges and universities began under President Franklin Roosevelt. He was looking to continue the innovation and advances that came out of World War II.
And in the last few months, the nation and the world have seen marches for science and climate change, marches attended by hundreds of thousands of people.
But with competing priorities for governmental funding, there have been cuts proposed to some of the main research agencies, and that could have a serious impact on research for institutions like UW-Madison, which receive significant funding through those programs.
Rebecca Blank is chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She and vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison, Marcia Malik, recently wrote an opinion piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel titled Strengthen the Government Science Partnership. Chancellor Blank, thank you for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
You recently signed onto a statement by presidents and chancellors from 60 public and private research universities, and you made the case for the importance of investing in research. Why did you and your colleagues feel that it was important to make that case right now?
So at this particular moment in time, there are proposals in the federal budget to very substantially cut the research dollars that the federal government gives to universities. We've had a, 60, 70-year partnership between research universities and the federal government by which they fund the basic scientific research, which in turn results in the new technologies of the future. And the current federal proposals are deep enough cuts that I think all of us who signed that letter believe that it fundamentally threatens that partnership.
Can you give us a sense of how the last few decades have been for federal support for research? What have you seen happen to funding?
So federal support for research depends a little in what area you're talking about. In general, over the last number of decades, federal support of research has increased. Now, expenses on research have increased, and so I wouldn't be able to do an inflation-adjusted calculation of that. But that increase has gone heavily into a whole variety of health-related areas. There's actually some very good research on this, the extent to which basic scientific research on things like heart disease and cancer and other factors have really changed treatments over time in a way that's resulted in far more lives saved or, you know, longer lives and better lives of many, many Americans. Similarly, there's been increases in the sort of research that goes into computer sciences, as that field has just exploded. And much of that research funded now 20 and 30 years ago, even 40, was fundamental to the sort of software that exists inside those phones that you carry around with you every day, or the GPS systems that allow people to identify where they're going and, you know, where they want to be. So you see these this very basic science work, which over time has resulted in changes to technology that have made our lives better. And that is to say, it's an important partnership.
Has there been research, though, that's been left behind? Those have been the advances, but what's been left behind?
So here's the problem. When you're funding basic science, you don't know what 20 years from now is going to be useful and what isn't. Basic science is about trying to explain the world, right? How do our bodies work? How does the solar system work? How do things mechanically interact with each other? What sort of metals or oils or how do you do a much more efficient software algorithm that lets you speed up certain processes? You cannot today, when you look at, you know, if I'm going to fund someone doing interesting work on the human body, tell you that this will guaranteed result in a reduction in cancers 20 years from now. What I can tell you is that in the past, that type of investment has repaid itself. And I think the estimates are something like 5 and 6 times. You know, I'm particularly talking about the health sciences here. So that while any one research project always has uncertainty about it, the funding the federal government has done over time has had an enormous positive impact on people and on the economy.
And you make the case for us why the federal government, instead of, say, private enterprises, should invest heavily in research, because we're talking about taxpayer dollars here.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's often a question of why doesn't industry pay for this? And the issue is industry is very good at paying for applied science. Once they know that I want to make a battery that does A, B, and C, they will themselves hire a group of researchers to focus on making A, B, and C happen, right? But if you want someone to say, how do you build a battery that runs on something entirely different than the batteries we've been using? Industry isn't going to fund that, because when you do that type of research, it's, you know, there's all sorts of ideas. Some of them work, some of them don't. And industry tends to be very focused on funding something that we think we can apply in the next 2 to 3 to 5 years. Basic research is rarely that immediately applicable. And what you can show is that basic science research, whether in the health area, the mechanical area, the computer area, has enormous long-term gains. But the results tend to be very generalizable. It's not clear who's going to take advantage of it, which company, which industry will most benefit. And as a result, no one company is going to pay that bill. I mean, it's a classic problem of it's sort of a public good to do basic science research. And the results of that over time will reach a point that industry will grab it and go with it. I mean, you see, for instance, pharma, the big pharmaceutical companies, taking ideas when they're at a certain point in the lab. But the big pharmaceutical companies have no interest whatsoever in funding the really basic molecule-level research that is required for you to get to a point where you have something that the pharmaceutical industry wants to work with.
We're talking right now with UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank about the role of research at universities, both public and private, and she recently wrote an op-ed piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that lays out a case that government-funded research is in America's best interest. And Chancellor Blank, the National Institutes of Health is getting a $2 billion boost in funding in the bipartisan spending plan that keeps the government running through the end of September. But this goes against what President Trump had wanted to do to NIH, was to reduce its budget for the rest of the fiscal year. I'm wondering, how do research organizations like universities, like the NIH, adjust to the volatility of funding and the politics that surround these decisions?
Well, you know, it's a very real problem, because most of these research projects are, you know, 2, 5, sometimes even 10 and 20 year projects before they come to fruition. And when, you know, research dollars go up and down, you have very serious issues of attracting and keeping, particularly your young scientists, who you want to bring in and give some stable funding to so they can reach a point in their careers that, you know, that they're really doing successful work. What has been true is that particularly the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, has had huge bipartisan support by both Democrats and Republicans, and I think some of that is because of its real history of success in coming, you know, funding things that over time really make a difference to human health and to the health of this country. So that there's been a real reluctance, you know, certainly in this last round of funding to cut the NIH, and in fact they put more money into it. I don't know what's going to happen in this next budget that's coming out this week. That budget is going to propose very deep cuts in energy research, in funding, in probably ag research, certainly in healthcare research, and you know, we'll see where the bipartisan support for this holds. It's going to be a very interesting thing to watch for those of us who care about the ways in which basic research fuels the economy and fuels the future of America. It's a very concerning thing to watch.
Turning to the UW, what are some of the areas in which UW is excelling in research that is independent on government funding?
Well, we are one of the top universities in the world in terms of biological-related research, and that's everything from medical research to plants to animals, and partly because we have on our campus both all of the health sciences, the medical school, public health, nursing, and pharmacy. We also have the veterinary medical school, and we have a wonderful College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And they interact in all sorts of ways. Not a lot of other schools have all of those units on one single campus. And that has given us an enormous advantage. Now, that's funded in part by the USDA, by the Agricultural Department. It's funded in part by NIH and the National Institutes of Health. It's funded in part by a variety of other places. The National Science Foundation is a funder. The Energy Department is a funder of some of this. So we get money from a lot of different places and put it, I think, to very good use. And it's a very competitive field. We wouldn't get that money if we hadn't been putting it to good use. I think it's something like for every $100 in research proposals that these organizations get, they only fund about $8 to $10 worth. So it's very, very competitive to get this money.
Is it also effective for you to diversify where your funding has come from? So in case some funding drops out, albeit whether it's federal or something else, that you're able to do some quick maneuvering in order to keep the research going?
Well, you know, as I indicated earlier, outside the federal government, there is almost nobody who wants to put big money into basic science research. That has always been a federal university partnership. So when the federal dollars fall, there's large amounts of research on this campus that we could not find other funding for. Now, we do also have quite a bit of funding from industry, but that tends to be much more applied and focused on very specific things that are already ways down the road as opposed to just the basic science.
Finally, what do you hope to see come out of advocacy efforts like this statement that you signed, you and dozens of colleagues across the country?
Well, we want to raise concerns about the potential impact of these very large budget cuts in research. You know, one way of saying this, if you want to look at this as a market, other countries in the last 10 to 20 years have hugely increased their investments in basic science research, mostly at their own universities. And they're doing that because they've looked at the United States and looked at the ways in which our basic science research here has fueled our leadership in the world economy now for five, six, seven decades. They want to repeat that inside their countries. If we're cutting back on our research, they're simply going to surge forward. And when you come along 30 and 40 years from now and saying, who's on the front edge of health changes, of new technologies, it's not going to be the United States. It's going to be other countries that have continued and deepened their funding. So, I mean, this is a really basic competitive issue for the United States and its world leadership.
Chancellor Blank, thank you for speaking with us today.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Rebecca Blank is Chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us to talk about a statement that she and other college and university officials published recently that calls for continued federal investment in research.
Researchers don't like to apply the term psychopath to children, but about 1% of children exhibit what the American Psychiatric Association diagnoses as unemotional and callous behavior.
The behavior includes lack of empathy or guilt, shallow emotions, aggression, and even cruelty, and a seeming indifference to punishment. Research shows that kids with callous and unemotional behavior are more likely to go on to exhibit psychopathic traits or commit crimes as adults.
In the past, the diagnosis of psychopathy was one without a cure or effective treatment.
But new approaches are working to better understand the brains of psychopaths and use that knowledge to get to effective treatment. In particular, two psychologists at the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison have had success working with youth like this using rewards.
Barbara Bradley Haggerty just wrote about their work and more in her new piece for The Atlantic called When Your Child is a Psychopath. Barbara was with NPR for 18 years. Her latest book is called Life Reimagined. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Well, you start with the story of a girl named Samantha who's in treatment for exhibiting some of this callous and unemotional behavior. Can you tell us about her?
Yes, yes. When I met her, she was 11 years old. That was just a couple of months ago. And from really an early age, she showed distressing traits. She would, you know, hurt her siblings and smile when they cried, things like that. When she was 6 years old, she was being driven by her mom and her other siblings were in the car as well. They were driving along a windy road, and suddenly her mom heard screaming from the back, and this girl, Samantha, had her hands around her little sister's neck and was trying to kill her, choke her. And the girl was trapped in the car seat. And when they got back home, Jen, the mother, managed to kind of separate them. And when they got back home, Jen said to Samantha, you know, what were you doing? And she said, I was trying to choke her. And she said, Jen said, you know, you could have killed her. And she said, yeah, I know. And Jen said, you know, what about the rest of us? And Samantha, 6 years old, said, oh, I want to kill all of you. So this is the kind of extreme behavior that you see among children. I mean, it's really pretty dramatic. So if your kid is misbehaving, don't think that your child is heading towards psychopathy. But when you see this kind of behavior, it's pretty scary. And for a long time, people thought that it couldn't be cured, couldn't be affected.
Why was that? What was it about it that made it so difficult to treat?
Well, I mean, part of it is that they hadn't really looked at children. They had looked at adults. And by the time you're an adult, your brain is pretty... I mean, it's still changing, but it's not changing the way it is when you're a child. What they're beginning to believe is that that children may be able to, we may be able to train them to have a certain cognitive morality instead of a kind of feeling moral, feeling empathy, feeling remorse. We may be able to train them to kind of know what the right thing is to do and do it even though they don't feel like it. And with adults, it's really hard to do that. So adults who don't feel empathy, who don't worry about punishment, who have an overactive reward system, it's really hard to stop them from doing something bad if they want to do it. Children, they hope it'll be a little easier to train them not to do those things.
And there are some differences, it turns out, in the brains of psychopaths versus the brains of people who don't have that diagnosis. Can you tell us about those differences and where that trail of breadcrumbs is leading?
So there are kind of two neurological quirks that psychologists point to. One is that their emotional system is not very robust. The limbic system, the amygdala, the fight or flight system that you hear about, that psychopaths, their brains don't respond to emotional cues. So, for example, one researcher was telling me that she was talking to a psychopathic adult in prison, and she showed him a picture of a fearful face. And what we know is that the amygdala in that person probably didn't respond to that fearful face. And the guy looked at it and said, you know, I don't know what you call that emotion, but it's what people look like just before you stab them. Now, what that means is a psychopath don't understand the cue of, gee, I am afraid, please don't hurt me, I'm submitting here. If you don't understand that cue, then you're more likely to attack someone whom other people wouldn't attack. The other part of the brain is that they have a kind of an overactive reward system. So the brakes don't work. When they get it into their head that they want to do something, that they want that, you know, that little boy's toy truck, or that they want to steal that car and push the driver out, when they get it into their head that they want to do that, their brain doesn't stop them. It doesn't consider the consequences. So those two things make it really, really, it's kind of a really bad combination, and it heads towards psychopathy.
And one thing, though, that does seem to work especially well is the reward center of the brain. How does that work?
Right. So the reward system is the kind of flip side of the brakes not working, is that the reward center is going on overdrive. And this has provided kind of a key about how you might treat some of these kids. So what they've done at Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center is they have de-emphasized, they give swift punishment, but they don't give long-range punishment, because what they know about these kids is they do not respond to punishment. What they do respond to, we know, is reward. And so what they do is they create a system of rewards. So if you are good, if you don't break the rules, then you can join Club 19 and get pizza on Saturday, and Club 23, and VIP Club, and get increasing numbers of rewards, Pokemon cards, basketball cards, internet radio, that kind of thing. And what's happened is that these kids respond to the reward. And the whole idea is that, gee, these kids may never kind of want to do the right thing, but if we can train them through the system of rewards, that if they do the right thing, if they play within, you know, the law, if they color within the lines, then their lives will be better. They will get Pokemon cards. They will not be put in prison. They may have a family and friends and things like that. They will get rewards, and so it's in their self-interest to do the right thing. And that's what Mendota is trying to do, and they're having some early success, actually.
Right, and you visited the Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center in Madison and spoke with a couple of psychologists who were sort of pioneers in this treatment. Could you tell us about their early days and what they're seeing now?
Yes. So they started, Mendota was opened in 1995 because the state thought that, gosh, instead of just throwing juveniles into jail, into prison, and having them come out later as kind of more hardened criminals, why don't we try to treat them as this is a psychiatric problem? So they created Mendota, and they put it under the Department of Health Services and not the Department of Corrections. Psychologists and psychiatric care technicians run it, not guards and wardens. They have one staff for every three kids. And what this means is, and this was begun in 1995, and what this means is that these kids are getting a lot of attention. This is often the relationships that they have with their staff. The staff there are often the first genuine and safe relationships they've had with anyone, as, you know, and they go there when they're 14, 15, 16, 17. You know, and so what they do is they develop these relationships with these people, and they learn to kind of, they call it decompression. They learn how to deal with the slings and arrows, the difficulties of life, not through violence, but through, you know, listening to therapy, by, you know, having relationships. They actually learn other methods, get other tools in their toolbox to deal with difficulties rather than just violence, which is what they've known before.
And Barbara, we're almost out of time, but just briefly, is it working? Where are we now with that?
Yeah, the early studies really suggest it is working. So they've followed kids, about 250 kids. Some of them regular juvenile delinquents, and others went through Mendota. And what they have found is, after 4.5 years of their release, the kids who went through Mendota, who were the more dangerous kids, they ended up being much less likely to reoffend, much less likely to commit a violent crime. And here's the kicker. The juvenile delinquents, the regular kids, they killed 16 people within this 4.5 year period. The kids from Mendota, the more dangerous kids, they didn't kill a single person. So it seems to be working, at least in the early days.
Barbara, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
That was Barbara Bradley Haggerty. She was with NPR for 18 years, and she joined us to talk about her article about new treatment for child psychopaths for The Atlantic. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
The probe into Russian interference during the 2016 presidential election is still underway. Today, former CIA Director John Brennan delivered testimony to the House Intelligence Committee. In the testimony, he said he began to get worried about a potential problem with Russian meddling last summer.
This testimony comes on the heels of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn pleading the Fifth about his potential ties to Russia and refusing to turn over documents to the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Chris Edelson joins us now to talk about all that news. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at American University. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a couple big revelations in particular in the last 24 hours or so. Among them, former CIA Director John Brennan testified today that he began getting worried about possible Russian influence last year, and specific last summer. And here's a little bit of his testimony.
I encountered and am aware of information and intelligence that revealed contacts and interactions between Russian officials and U.S. persons involved in the Trump campaign that I was concerned about because of known Russian efforts to suborn such individuals. And it raised questions in my mind, again, whether or not the Russians were able to gain the cooperation of those individuals. I don't know whether or not such collusion, that's your term, such collusion existed. I don't know. But I know that there was a sufficient basis of information and intelligence that required further investigation by the Bureau to determine whether or not U.S. persons were actively conspiring, colluding with Russian officials.
For a former CIA director to say this, that he had this level of concern, how significant is that?
It's a big deal. I think it's the first time, as far as I can tell, that a U.S. official has publicly said this. It confirms reporting. We've heard a number of reports that there were contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians, and that there's an investigation to see if there was cooperation. Director Comey testified about that part of it, his testimony. But, of course, the Trump administration, Donald Trump himself, has said there's no investigation regarding cooperation. So this contradicts what the Trump administration and the president are saying.
And in this clip we just heard from the testimony, Brennan is very careful to say that he does not know whether there was collusion. He even says, this is your word, collusion, not my word. How much hinges on this word and what it's going to mean going forward?
Well, I think there's two issues there. One is, it's important to say, the reason he's saying that is because he's not involved in that. He was the CIA director. He was looking at intelligence. When he found there was a possibility of collusion, he in fact said, he mentioned the possibility of treason. He said people don't always realize they're being led on a treasonous path. He seems to have referred that to the FBI to investigate. So the reason he doesn't know is because he didn't look at that evidence. The second point is, collusion is not the only issue here. I think we know enough already, based just on public statements by the Trump administration, that there are real problems, mostly having to deal with possible obstruction of justice. But that's all public. That's not a question of secret cooperation. We also know publicly that Donald Trump encouraged the Russians to intervene to release emails of Hillary Clinton. So a lot of what we know, I think one of the problems in dealing with what's happening is we know so much of this publicly through things that Donald Trump has said.
So what problems does that raise for you specifically when you look at the scope of an investigation like this?
I think it confuses people because people are used to, in Watergate, there was a slow stream of information and there was a smoking gun and a tape that showed that Richard Nixon was interfering with an investigation. We know based on what Donald Trump has said, at least based on reports, that Donald Trump has done this, and some of the reason we know this is because he said this publicly. So I think the fact that this has happened so quickly and that so much of it is public, and Donald Trump has said this both in an interview with Lester Holt of NBC and apparently when speaking with the Russians based on a report from an administration official who was there, who was anonymously quoted, I think it's confusing because people don't really know what to do with this. We have a president who's made statements that indicate possible obstruction of justice based just voluntarily.
So when you look at that public statement of what has happened from the words of the sitting president, and you're an investigator, maybe you're on one of these committees in the House or the Senate, what big questions are you trying to answer here?
Well, it depends what part of it you're looking at. So there are at least two separate streams here. One question is, was there obstruction of justice? So the question there will be, what did the president say? What was his intent? Importantly, you prove obstruction of justice based on what someone intended. Did they have a corrupt intent to interfere with the investigation? So that's one issue. And a lot of that comes from his public statements, as I said. There's a pattern that has to be put together. Then on the collusion side, what you're looking at is information I have no access to, of course. You know, what exactly? We know that there were contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russians based on Brennan's testimony today and also reporting. What exactly happened in those contacts? We don't know very much. Sally Yates, the acting attorney general, did testify recently about this. She said that when she found out what Flynn had discussed with the Russian ambassador, Kislyak, she was concerned for two reasons. One, he might be susceptible to blackmail. And two, in her words, she said the underlying communication was problematic. We don't know exactly what that means. So the question would be, of course, did that involve some kind of quid pro quo? Was there cooperation? Was the Trump administration actively involved in some way in what we know were Russian attempts to interfere in the election to help Donald Trump win?
Chris Edelston is with us right now from American University, and we're talking about the ongoing probe into Russian interference during the 2016 presidential election. And another bit of new information from testimony recently, it came to light that Donald Trump had asked two top intelligence officials to deny the existence of any evidence of collusion between his campaign and Russia. Can you fill us in on that, Chris?
A big story. I mentioned the Nixon comparison before. People, of course, draw a connection here because this is one of the things Nixon was accused of, trying to interfere with the investigation. So we have reports on Friday, I believe it was, as you said, that Trump personally spoke with both the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, and the NSA Director, Rogers, and asked them to say things which an intelligence official was quoted as saying, that Trump asked them to say things that were false regarding an ongoing investigation. And as I said before, on the obstruction of justice side, this is another piece that you look at. You say, is this part of a pattern of Donald Trump actively trying to interfere with and stop and undermine an investigation? And this is one of just a number of pieces of information we have now about this.
And what did Coates and Rogers say specifically in their testimony? How much substance do we have there of those conversations?
They haven't talked about it. As best as I can tell, it's hard. There's so many hearings going on today, couldn't follow all of them. But Coates was asked about this, and he wouldn't answer. But he did say he would answer separately in another context, I imagine in the context of an investigation or a closed hearing. So we don't know what his response is. All we have is the reporting. It'll be interesting to see if he's asked about that in another context and whether we find out. One point is, with a special counsel looking at this now, Robert Mueller, what he's doing is secret. And some people have pointed out, I think quite rightly, we need Congress to publicly investigate as well and in a bipartisan way through a select committee that can look at some of these things publicly as best as they can. There are some issues here that won't involve criminal matters that the public needs to know about, and hopefully there will be a way to do that.
So in terms of what we know about Russia's goals in the meddling in the 2016 election, how much do we know about what their goals were? Was it simply to get Donald Trump elected president, or was it also to hurt Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think the two go together. As best as I can tell from the reporting and the little that was released by the intelligence community publicly, the conclusion is that the Russians intervened in an attempt to undermine Hillary Clinton and elect Donald Trump. Hurting Hillary Clinton would help Donald Trump. It seems that the Russians thought that Clinton would still win, and they were hoping that even if they didn't elect Donald Trump, it would still hurt her, and they'd be able to kind of wound her as president. But their goal, the intelligence community concluded, was to elect Donald Trump. That's a pretty shocking thing to know. Of course, by itself, that's shocking. The second part that's even more potentially explosive is we know, based on reporting and based on testimony today, that some Trump officials were in contact with the Russians. Were they helping with that? And it's so difficult to even think about this, because if that's the case, it's really really calls the election's legitimacy into doubt.
When we look at the case of former NSA advisor Michael Flynn, what do we know about his role in this? He was one of the first pieces of this puzzle to come together. What are the lingering questions about where he stands today?
There's a lot. Michael Flynn was a retired general, and as such, he was supposed to report, by law, payments from foreign governments. He was paid by both the Russians and the Turks, as far as we know, about, I think, $500,000 by the Turkish government, $45,000 for the Russians. Reporting suggests he didn't tell who he was supposed to tell about this, which could be a criminal violation. It's not clear. He also has obligations to report that he's acting as a foreign agent. It's not clear that he did that. And it's not. There are also reports, I think it was just today, that he misled Pentagon investigators about whether he received payments, and that by itself could be a criminal offense. So there are a number of issues here. He was asked to turn over documents by the Senate. He has refused to do so, citing the Fifth Amendment. The Senate can take action to compel production of those documents. They've suggested, Senator Burr, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, suggested that by the end of the day today, he would say what they're going to do about that. But I think Michael Flynn is in a very difficult situation. And, of course, one problem is Donald Trump seems to have taken action to help Michael Flynn. He spoke to Jim Comey, reporting says, and said to Comey, hey, Michael Flynn's a good guy. Can you let this go? And Jim Comey, based on reporting, has a memo documenting that. So that, of course, would be another piece of this possible obstruction of justice issue.
Chris Nettleson is with us right now. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at American University. And he's joining us to talk about this ongoing probe into Russian meddling during the 2016 presidential election.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this ongoing investigation? And how does this investigation influence your opinion of the Trump administration? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the ongoing investigation into Russia and its role in the 2016 presidential election. Chris Edelston stays with us. He's assistant professor in the Department of Government at American University.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this investigation? And do you agree with President Trump, who doesn't believe that the investigation is fair? Or do you think it's necessary to determine the role that Russia had in last year's election? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Tony joining us from Decorah, Iowa. Tony, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Good, yeah. First of all, to let you all know, I'm a Democrat, and I did vote for Nader, and I did sit out of the election because of Hillary. But, you know, I just want to say a couple things. One was that Comey you know, went before Congress in the beginning of May, and he was asked if he was influenced by any outside sources, and he said no. And I don't think a lot of people are talking about that, you know, when he did go before Congress. And I'm concerned about that, that you know, for one, he could face some type of perjury, or that he, you know, he put himself in a conflict of interest by coming up with memos. Second of all, I just want to say that, you know, as a Democrat, I look at the fact that what America wants. And America wanted a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate and a Republican president. I think it's our duty now to try to help them become a good, you know, the best that they, you know, they can be. And I feel like sometimes I'm hearing a lot of people trying to undermine and work against the Republicans, and I just have concerns about that.
Tony, thank you for that call. Some interesting nuances there in what you're saying, but I want to start, if we could, Chris, with his thoughts about FBI Director James Comey. What do you think about that?
I didn't quite understand the thing about not being influenced by outside sources. I think a key issue, as the caller mentioned, will be Comey's memos. We've heard reporting they exist. Do they exist? What do they say? Apparently, Special Counsel Mueller is looking at them, so we'll all find out. On the second point, it's really important to say this. This is not a partisan issue. This has nothing to do with what Donald Trump thinks about health care or taxes or immigration. Republicans have recognized this. Congressman Justin Amash from Michigan just said the other day, if the reports about Trump pressuring Comey are right, Amash said this merits impeachment. Senator John McCain said his words were, this is a Watergate size and scale of what's going on. Congressman Elijah Cummings, who's a Democrat, said this is a fight for the soul of our democracy. I think that's absolutely right. This has nothing to do with partisanship. This has to do with the question of, do we have the tools as a country to respond to questions involving the rule of law and holding a president accountable? Or can a president decide for himself or herself at some point whether they can simply put themselves above the law? This is a Nixonian type of issue. We haven't seen this in a long time. It's difficult to talk about because I understand the caller's point. It sounds partisan when you're criticizing someone, but it really has nothing to do with partisanship. It has to do with basic questions about the rule of law, and it's really essential to our democracy to sort this out.
Now, the Trump administration has been saying all along, you know, it's the leaks. That's the 800-pound gorilla that nobody's talking about. What do you say to that critique from the White House?
Nixon said the same thing. He created a team called the Plumbers. They were called the Plumbers because their job was to plug leaks. That was the infamous team that broke into the Watergate Hotel. I think it's a distraction. I think I don't know enough to say right now what's right and what's wrong, but I think there are important questions that have been raised. As Congressman Amash said, if this is right, this rises the level of obstruction of justice. It is really important to be fair about this. Obstruction of justice is a criminal charge. The president can't be charged criminally while in office. If this was brought, it would be in the context of an impeachment, but an impeachment requires a trial, too. So it's important not to rush to judgment. These things have to be sorted out, but these are really important questions, and the comment about leaks, I think, is really a distraction.
Let's take another caller now. We've got John joining us from Owen. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
So I'm just trying to find out, to me, there's a lot of stuff going around about what was reportedly said or not said, but what do we know that actually was said or what was so wrong about what was done? I mean, to make all these, you know, accusations and claims about and even talking impeachment when we haven't even had a complete workup yet or, you know.
Mm-hmm. John, thank you for the call. And John, I think getting at, you know, if you have a president, a candidate, a non-president who was communicating with the Russians, what is it about that in particular that may breach the rule of law?
Yeah, I mean, the caller's right. It's hard to keep track of this. There are two things to look at. One is the extraordinary reporting that the intelligence community concluded the Russians were trying to influence the election to elect Donald Trump, and other reports that the Trump campaign spoke with the Russians. We do not know enough about that yet to know what it means. It could mean that the Trump campaign was actively helping the Russians. It could mean they were speaking to the Russians about something else. It's hard to sort that out for sure and know exactly what that means. The second point is what people call the cover-up. That's a little bit of a corny term. But what that means is in the course, while there's been an investigation of what happened with Russia, there are concerns that the Trump administration, Donald Trump himself, has sought to obstruct justice by pressuring Jim Comey, asking Jim Comey to declare his loyalty to him, asking Jim Comey to let this investigation go, firing Jim Comey when he didn't go along with that, firing Sally Yates as well, the acting attorney general, firing Preet Bharara, U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, and then telling the Russians that he had fired Jim Comey to take the pressure off. So That's the second piece of it. We don't, it's true, we don't know enough there either to determine what that all means. As Congressman Justin Amash said, though, if that's right, if the reporting about what Trump did to influence and potentially undermine the investigation is right, I think that does raise obstruction of justice concerns, but it absolutely requires more information. That's completely correct. It should be done both through the special counsel, who is looking at criminal issues, and through Congress. And I think a concern I have is that this, some Republicans recognize this is a bipartisan matter. Not all do, unfortunately. And today in the testimony, a lot of Republicans were asked, we're clearly trying to defend President Trump, which is a mistake. This is not a partisan matter. We need to figure out what's happened. And I would like to see Congress, as I mentioned, create a bipartisan select committee to take a look at this as well. There are no predetermined conclusions here. We need to find out if this is wrong. Donald Trump needs to have that explained. But if it's not, this is a really big problem.
I want to share a comment here from Sharon on Facebook, who said, ultimately, what does this mean for the Trump presidency? If impeached, would he be ousted, convicted of a criminal offense, or can he be arrested as a sitting president? What about those?
Probably not. I mean, these things come up so rarely that it's hard to say with certainty. But here's probably, this is all speculative at this point. It's not going to happen right now. But if Congress decided there was enough information to impeach him, the way it would happen was the House Judiciary Committee would begin debating this. They would take a vote. If there was a majority vote, it would go to the House as a whole. If a majority in the House, a simple majority, decided to impeach, then there's a trial in the Senate, which is presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and it would require a two-thirds majority to convict, meaning the president's removed from office. None of that is happening anytime in the near future, if at all. If he was convicted at that point and removed from office, or if he resigned, President Nixon resigned before it got that far when the impeachment proceedings began, then there'd be a question, could there be any other proceedings held? But it's too early to speculate for sure about that. But the way it would happen is, if there was some basis for a criminal charge against the president, it would probably have to wait till he was out of office, if at all. But that's completely speculative right now. We don't know.
Now, you mentioned how complicated this is. We have the House Oversight Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee. It goes on. Could you tell us what you're looking at so that we can have some clear benchmarks as we go forward to see what's happening?
I mean, I try to keep in my head the timeline of what's happened, the important pieces that have been reported that go to either the Russia questions or the potential interference of the investigation. What I'm looking for right now is the special counsel, what will happen with that. But the problem, of course, is the special counsel's investigation could take months or even years, and it will be secret. We may never know what the special counsel has determined. He's not required to issue a report. So I'm interested in that, but I don't know how much information we'll get publicly about that. What I'm also interested in is seeing whether Republicans in Congress recognize that this is a real national crisis and it needs to be addressed. That does not require, that certainly doesn't mean any predetermined conclusion, but it means the public needs to know. Your callers are raising all these good questions, and we need to have this discussed publicly, and as much information as can be made public should be made public in a bipartisan way. So what I'm really, every day I wake up and I wonder, will today be the day that there's bipartisan action taken? Over the last week or so, we've seen some signs of that. Republicans in Congress have asked for documents from Michael Flynn, for instance, have expressed interest and have asked for the memos that Jim Comey reportedly wrote. Mm-hmm. But that's a good sign, because we need to find out, do they exist? What do they actually say? This is all based on reports. And that's what I'm really looking at. Will we see some kind of bipartisan movement to get this information out to the public?
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us.
Of course. My pleasure. Thanks very much.
That's Chris Edelston, assistant professor at American University, joining us to talk about the ongoing investigation into the influence that Russia had in the 2016 election.
And you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.